This is the 50th Anniversary History Conference in Nashville, Tennessee, October 3rd to the 5th, 2003. The recording from the conference belongs to the public domain. The next speaker is Fawn and Chuck. Please introduce the speaker in your own words. Thank you. We just did. Okay, we're ready to roll.
You're rolling.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll just get started. I'll ask you some questions. You can ask me some questions. When did you first come to Narcotics Anonymous?
I got clean in Narcotics Anonymous in July 21, 1978. And that's when I surrendered and have stayed clean ever since. How about you?
I got clean March 11th, 1970, in Narcotics Anonymous.
Where did you get clean, Chuck?
I got clean in the San Fernando Valley. And most of my recovery has been in the San Fernando Valley. So. Where was I living? I was living in Sherman Oaks. We were renting an apartment in Sherman Oaks. I got clean.
How did you hear about Narcotics Anonymous?
My dad was also an addict. He was going to AA, and I just got bailed out of jail, and my mom and wife said maybe you should go where your dad's going. So I went to AA meeting, and they said, I was talking about being an addict, and they said, why don't you go to Narcotics Anonymous? I think that was the wisest thing they could have told me was, why don't you go to Narcotics Anonymous? And so I'm grateful that they pushed me in the way of Narcotics Anonymous, and that was because it was very unknown then. It was only... I've got a card that I brought with me that was in the early 70s, so it was even smaller when I got here, but it was like the card I have is about 73, and it's got 5 meetings on it. And then the meetings, of course there was no phone lines or anything like that. The phone lines were the people. And on the phone line list, was about 8 people, and that's who you called. That was the hotline, and one of those people was Jimmy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you remember the conversation? Can you remember parts of it, or what that conversation was like? Or
with the
that conversation that you had with Jimmy that day?
No, this was on the card that I have that shows all the different people on it. So instead of having a hotline like we do today where you call one number, there was like 8 people that are on this card, and then you probably picked out which one you wanted to call, and that was the hotline. You know, because we didn't have any, there was no answering services then, there was no... You definitely did not get a phone machine because there were no phone machines.
Right, yeah. Right.
There was no call waiting.
Right.
Yeah, so you would get through to somebody. Still the old dial. we were just starting to switch over to push button. Yeah, so that's the way the hotline was at that time. And so there was 5 meetings in the San Fernando Valley. And that was it. So, of course, the other two we'd have to substitute with AA. But
now, tell me, back when you got clean, there really wasn't that idea that addiction was a disease yet in the medical world or in society. Didn't they still look at it as a more or less like a crime, or how was it being an addict back when you first got clean, or was it an underground thing, or did you have to sneak around, or?
That was before my time. I'm when I was going through the legal system, that was a part of it. If you hung around with other addicts, that was part of usually part of your probation or your parole, was that you won't conjugate with other addicts. And if you did, then that was, you picked up another beat for doing that. But when I came to NA, it was okay to be. That was before I got here, because I've heard some of the stories of Jimmy, and I think that was probably back in the 50s, maybe some of the 60s, but I think it's more so in the 50s that was happening.
So it was becoming, society was starting to recognize addiction as a disease.
I would think so. I think they were looking at it because they had already figured that alcohol was a disease, and so I think they were figuring more that addiction was a disease too. Although Narcotics Anonymous was not recognized as the place to be when I first got here, it seemed like it was okay for if you were new. Okay, that's when you went when you were new. But as soon as you got a little bit of time, the thing was, yeah, if you wanted to really recover, then you had to go to AA, because that's where all the recovery was. And that's what I ran across when I was new. If you want recovery, you go to AA. And it was just something that I felt like, this is the spot that I should be, was in Narcotics Anonymous. And that was, I think, the best decision that I could have made was that this is where I'm supposed to be, is in NA. And besides that, I like the smallness of it too. I like small meetings. And when I ran into Jimmy, that's what he liked too. He always liked the small meetings, and as you know, he liked being on a one-to-one basis or just a small group. He wasn't into being in a large meeting, although he'd go to large meetings, but he was always, I think, felt more comfortable in a small group atmosphere, especially at his house.
Yeah. How many people were in the average NA meeting?
My first meeting was probably, there was probably 15 people there, something like that.
Was the average addict a heroin addict, would you say?
Most of the people were heroin addicts, yeah.
And how far reaching was NA? Were NA meetings, how far out of the San Fernando Valley do you remember did they go?
Oh, if you were going to NA, you would go all over the place. You'd go to Manhattan Beach, you'd go to Burbank, Glendale, Whittier. You knew everybody that was a regger in Narcotics Anonymous. It was just like, I ran across Jack Whaley, and Jack Whaley lived over in the, the Bay Area there, and Chuck Skinner, where he lived out in Whittier, and all the different people that were in Mel. Ran across Mel because he was in that same area. A lot of other people too. So you traveled around if you wanted to go to a meeting. Just like probably a lot of the United States is doing today. They running the same stuff that we ran into 30, 35 years ago.
When did you get a sponsor?
I got a sponsor pretty quick. I got a guy that had a year clean. He was a member of Narcotics Anonymous. He was also the one that pointed me or showed me Jimmy Cannon. And he was a lot younger than me. He was like 19 years old. I was like 28 then. And but I felt like this guy has got something that I want. He's clean, and he was a good guy. And he became my best friend. Yeah, he was a real neat guy, and I think he probably introduced me to Jimmy. That's the way he was. He'd take you around and introduce you to people, and he was an outgoing guy, and he ran into problems, though. He got it in his mind that he was probably too young to be an addict.
Right.
And that maybe he wasn't an addict. So, you know, what's the first thing you can do if you're not an addict? You can use it.
Right.
And as far as I know, he's still using. And so I had left him and told him I was going to get another sponsor, and that's when I got Jimmy. And so he actually had about, he had close to 5 years when he went out.
Wow.
And I'd already been with Jimmy, I think, a couple of years. So.
Do you remember what MA literature was available to you at that time in your recovery?
Just the white book.
So that would have been the, by that time it was the little white book with the stories in it already.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the
yeah,
stories.
it was the thinner white book.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was what we used, and we also had the big book at some of the meetings. I mean,
okay.
I remember being the secretary of a meeting and somebody saying, "Hey, where's the big book? Why isn't the big book here?" Because that's we didn't have any other literature. You know, so there's been a need for that for the book for a long time.
What about IPs? Were there any IPs?
No, I think the IPs started after that, later. I'm not sure what years Jimmy wrote the, started some of the IPs there, but, yeah.
Had you ever heard any, when did you start becoming active with Jimmy in terms of, like, help working with Jimmy and, on some of his service-related projects in his house and tapings or printing, or when did he start getting you dragging in with that?
I think the majority of it happened when we moved the office from, and maybe a little bit happened over when it was on Van Nuys Boulevard, but the majority of it happened when we moved it to Jimmy's house, which I think was about 1975, right around there. But it was... Even before that, he would be doing things when he wasn't connected to the office. Like I remember going. He'd say, "Hey, well, let's go. We're going to a school." And it was like doing PI. Well, we're going to go. He didn't call it PI, but that's what we're going to do. We're going to go out and do some give some information to the schools. And we'd go in, and he'd have me talk, and he'd talk, and there's always different things going on like that. So he was always, always active, you know.
So when you guys would go on these TI assignments to schools or different things, if you didn't have much literature to leave them, say, except for a white book, what sort of message did you give?
It was more of telling your story and about Narcotics Anonymous, and not too much different than what you share kind of at a meeting, but because we didn't exactly know, I didn't know exactly how to handle myself either. There was, you know, he didn't give me any rules or anything on, hey, this is just kind of tell your story, and that's what I do, and tell my story, and so that we let them know that Narcotics Anonymous is available. Yeah. You run into problems, and you know where to go. Which,
and were you asked to come out? Were you asked to come out and speak at a lot of the, say, high schools?
Not a lot. You know, that was just giving that as an example. He may take me somewhere else, he always had something going on where he was always involved and always wanting to carry the message. So, yeah, if you had somebody that needed a ride or needed to talk to and he didn't have the time, say, "Hey, well, maybe you could talk to this guy," you know. And so he was wanting to make sure everybody was covered, you know, If he didn't have the time to do it himself, then he wanted to make sure that person wasn't going to be dropped, because he was getting calls, I'm sure, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And after he, of course, got the office, then he was getting calls all the time.
What were some of the big, when you remember, like, your first 5 years in NA, What were some of the big challenges that faced NA back then? Like, what were some of the main struggles, or were there any?
I think the biggest struggle was that we were kind of, a lot of people felt we were kind of meshed together with AA. I think that was a big struggle. You know, we didn't have our own literature then. All we had was the basic text, not the basic text, but the little white book. And a lot of people were going back and forth between the two fellowships. And I think that that caused a lot of problems there. You know, so we weren't standing on our own at that point. We were dependent. A lot of people felt we were dependent on AA. I think once we started believing that, hey, we don't need to go anywhere else, then we started to grow. So that, I think that was our biggest challenge, is to believe that we could do this with Narcotics Anonymous alone, and then we started to grow.
Did you find that a lot of cooperation from AA back then? Were they referring addicts to NA, or do you just?
I think some of the AA people definitely wanted us to be in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, they felt that we should be going to NA, and I believe they were right. You know, we were different, really. You know, there was definitely a need for NA, and we were they had a hard time identifying with us, I think, and we had a hard time identifying with them because of our stories varied differently, I think, than a lot of alcoholics. So the identity, and that's why I believe that Jimmy started this, is that it was hard to identify, you know, and it was a lot of addicts were coming in, and me included, you know, I'm an addict, you know. I wanted them to tell me that there was no other, when I first went to that first AA meeting, I wanted them to tell me, hey, there's no, we can't help you here, so that I would have the option of going back out. But when they told me there was Narcotics Anonymous, I should go here. When I went to my first NA meeting, it was like, no, there's, you know, these people know me. I know them. This is where I belong.
When would you say that NA started to, like, when were some of the big growth spurts early on? When did you start to see NA start to come of age in the very early on? Like, what were some of the things that helped it move forward?
I think when it really started taking off, of course, is after the book came out. But I think I felt that it was coming of age, like when we had our 20th anniversary in 1973. But of course, Jack Whaley was, and I remember when Jack Whaley was talking about that, he was saying, we haven't come of age. And I thought, what is he talking about? We have. but I didn't realize that we were growing in California. But there wasn't so strong across the United States and across the world that we really hadn't come of age. You know, that it really hadn't gotten out the way that it has today. And the reason that it was hard for it to get out because there was no funds or nothing available to spread it like it is today.
What about the coming, when the advent of the NA tree, did that help? I mean, did that help to the more structure that came with NA, like the trustees, the forming of the trustees, or the tree, or some of the
other things? Good question, yeah. I think that that's actually when we started to grow more, is when we started, when we had the first conference. Then we started with a plan on, hey, how are we going to start doing this? You know, until then didn't seem like there was any plan, but after the conference, it was like there was things that were starting to go into motion, you know, and then they were talking more about the office and how the office was going to get started and kept going, and And that's when it moved into Jimmy's house is when it, it started to grow more. You know, that's, I think it started to blossom more in throughout the California, and it started to blossom throughout the United States more.
Would you say that's because we had maybe a fixed address or a fixed phone?
I think that's, I think we had before then there was nobody I think really sending out any starter packets or any there was nothing going out because there was nobody really volunteering at that time. When it went to Jimmy's house, and then things started to go out to the rest of the United States. So yeah, if at any time that it started to probably grow, I would say after that conference and moving it to Jimmy's house would be when it really started to unfold.
Now, there had been some attempts to get an established address for the office prior to it going into Jimmy's house. Why do you think those didn't work out? I mean, what were some of the drawbacks at those addresses, like on Highland Avenue, or you know, what happened?
I think
was it just too hard.
It was, yeah, I think it was there was just, you know, everybody's working. There was there was nobody that was permanent at those spots, so you were always relying on volunteers. Then we went from Highland to suicide prevention. I mean, which
I can just imagine how the phone was answered.
Kind of crazy set up there, and so and then to Van Nuys Boulevard, and then those were all just like temporary spots until it got to Jimmy's house, and then it was like we had a permanent spot, and we had a somebody that was permanent. That was, and Jimmy, you know, was on this like 24 hours a day. I mean, he was the one he was the one that answered the phone. You know, that was him. So he was.
And now I know once it got into his house, he counted on you quite a bit for to come by and to help him. And you were quite a fixture at his house for many years.
Yeah, well, I wanted to be a fixture there. Yeah, that was the spot that I felt best. I felt comfortable there. And, It was like a safe place to be. Yeah, I felt like I could anytime I wanted to, I could call and he would be there.
I'm taking orders if you want anything. You got another 20 minutes. You guys are doing great.
Okay. Yeah, I got to get to phone here.
Oh, I'm just having so much fun
listening
to you.
Well, I don't want to interrupt. I just want to know if I should grab you some coffee or water.
No, I've got water here.
Okay, a little bit of sweet malt. What was it like, your relationship and his? I mean, what was it like hanging out with him? What would you guys talk about? Was he like a funny guy? Because I know he was very respectful to women and all this, but...
I loved what you said last night about that, because that really touched me. Because he was.
Yeah, he was.
He was
very honored. And women, for the most part, always felt very safe around him because back then, you were on guard.
Yeah.
But around Jimmy, you could really relax.
Yeah.
You know, you knew that he would never say anything like a sexual remark or, you know, he was very gentleman. And there were definite, clear boundaries, very professional working environment, and he always treated women in a very, always they had just as much input into something.
That's right.
You know?
It was, they were never on a different level.
Right.
He was one of the few people that I believe that could sponsor women.
I remember he sponsored Marlene.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And she shared about that.
Yeah.
But so, well, what was it like having him as seeing him every day and hanging out with him? And
oh, he was he was a pleasure to hang out with because he just always upbeat, you know, always kind of whistling and just
And like, what was his advice to a young man, you know, in recovery, like when you'd have problems? I mean, what was his overall sort of advice to someone in recovery? I mean,
he was always he had a lot of different ways of carrying the message. You know, I remember him. There was sometimes I'd be talking to him, I didn't really know what he was talking about. He was very intelligent, and his vocabulary was very good, as you know. And sometimes I think, what in the heck is he talking about? And then sometimes he would sit down and he'd write out, this is, he'd have something where I've looked at that for this one thing that he wrote for me, that he wanted to show me that, because judging myself by others. And he wanted to show me that I needed to stick with me. To judge myself against myself, you know, that I didn't need to bring other people into this, that I needed to live up to my own expectations of myself rather than some expectations of somebody else. He wrote that out, and that was kind of the gist of it, but it was a real neat thing. And I saved that somewhere. I haven't been able to find it. But,
you'll find it.
Yeah, yeah. But he was willing to do whatever he needed to. He was also, you know, he helped me with my getting my state license. He wrote a letter for me, or wrote a letter to get me my pardon from the governor. And he was just willing to help whatever way he could. Yeah, just.
That's wonderful. Was there a project that the both of you what was it in the office that was like your baby?
Before I got into real estate, I was in, I worked in my dad's stereo place. So he knew that I knew stuff about recorders, and that was, you know, as you know, his big thing was he wanted to record everything. Everywhere he'd go, he'd be taking his recorder. It used to be the big reel-to-reel, and then he got a cassette, and then and he wanted to make tapes available to the fellowship.
I remember that tape library.
Yeah, so he had a tape library, and that's what we'd send out tapes to the fellowship. And you'd buy a tape, and then you pick out a tape that you want. There was a list of tapes, and then we'd record it. So my job, one of the jobs was to make those recordings. We got one of those recorders that record three at a time. We were all in heaven. He was in heaven on having that recorder, you know. And we borrowed one from the ashram.
Right.
Yeah, it was another spot that he would take. It took me up to. But we borrowed one from the ashram, and then later we were able to buy one for the office. And that was a big deal. It was to get the message out on tape where people could listen to it on cassette.
Later on in your recovery, when you started to sponsor men, did you bring them over and introduce them to him?
I tried to do the same thing he did to me.
Yeah,
yeah.
Get them busy.
Get them busy, yeah. Service. Yeah, you were,
So there was
actually, Phil was my first sponsee.
Oh.
Perez was my
Phil Perez.
Phil Perez was my first sponsee.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And then Phil Weber so if you were one of my sponsees, then that's what we were gonna do. We were gonna go over there, because I felt that was my way of carrying the message, was to go to Jimmy's and do what he wanted us to do. So
back when you were, gosh, that, it must have been exciting. exciting time to get clean because there was just so much to do in Narcotics Anonymous. If you wanted to get involved in service work, you could just take your pick.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, in fact, there was so much to do. We, as you know, you would take on a lot of different jobs. A lot of people didn't want to take on some of that stuff. So I know we're running short on time, so we're getting close to where you came on the program.
Oh yeah, I came in around in 78.
Right.
And I met Jimmy right away.
Right, you met him
like,
through Doug.
Through Doug, yeah. And you know, and it was a real sweet a sweet relationship. I just started. Gosh, it seems like it's. I just started typing away. And it wasn't like a modern typewriter either.
Yeah,
you know, I don't want Betty to hear that, but she was very proud of her typewriter. But you know, in terms of today's standards, it wasn't a Selectric typewriter. It was where you had to use the little lift-off tape, and then also typing the master sheets to run off on that mimeograph machine. And I don't remember the office having very brand new equipment or brand new files, but they were always neat and clean. And
did he have the little room there, the separate room that that was on. Okay.
Yeah.
He built that. He built that as the office. You know,
yeah, it was kind of like a mud room that was attached to the kitchen.
Right.
And then he converted that into the like the office where some file cabinets and my little typing desk was.
Yeah.
And of the phone, well, technically what was his desk, although I swear I never saw him sit down at the desk.
Yeah.
Maybe to write something down, but it always seemed, don't you seem to remember him always standing up?
Either standing or, buzzing around, making you a cup of coffee. Or
always walking around, humming, like you said.
Yeah.
Humming, just, you know, and then, or he was always making errands to the post office or to the printer to pick some stuff up. He always had his day charted out, planned, and he was never like, unshaven or walking around in his shorts. He was always dressed.
Always dressed, yeah.
You know? And he always answered the phone in a good way, you know?
Yeah.
You know, always.
Yeah.
See, I never remember him like, I mean, when I answer the phone sometimes, it's like, what is it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, or maybe I'm thinking that, but he always answered it cheerfully. That phone was always ringing. And remember when he used to answer the door, he would say, "Hey, what you say?" I remember that too. And,
So, what are your best memories of being over there or being around him?
I actually, when I was around him, there wasn't a lot of time to talk. I just remember working a lot, you know, typing a lot. He always had my assignments right there. He always knew the work that if he knew I was coming over, I think he really saw that was a bonus because there weren't many typists. There was Betty.
Yeah.
There was me, Lynn Endicott, when she was available. There was so much typing that needed to get done, whether it was retyping up a mimeograph or, you know, just getting things redone, that he set aside those times as being really good, precious time, and he didn't want to waste it. So he would have the stuff that I was going to do, like, there. You know, he didn't waste any time. He didn't want to sit around bullshit, you know?
Right.
So I knew when I was going over there, it was going to be to work.
Yeah, that's right.
But around the holidays, there was always time to have a little bit of free time. And by then, you know, sometimes Betty and I would go shopping. I do remember some of the sweetest times is when we all got along, and I'm talking about, you know, like Greg Pierce and Phil. When we were all, like, having dinner at each other's houses and
right.
making jewelry, and I remember one time we surprised Jimmy and Betty at their house, a bunch of us, even the residents at Cry Help, we all went Christmas caroling at Jimmy's house.
Yeah,
and
came over to my house too.
We went outside their house and we were all singing Christmas carols, and they invited us into their home, Jimmy and Betty did, and we all fit inside of that living room around their Christmas tree, and we just sang Christmas carols, and it made Jimmy and Betty so happy. And looking back on it now, I know it must have made Jimmy so happy, because you know how he loved addicts.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we just, and I remember, I'll never forget that evening, because it was Christmas Eve, I think it was, but I'll never forget how good it felt that moment, because I just didn't want to be anywhere else. And then I remember another time when we were taking a break or something, we were watching TV in his living room, and I was sitting on the floor, and he was sitting in his chair. And you know how he used to kind of curl up in his chair and have one knee up? Well, he was talking away, you know. And I was watching some, I don't know, Dragnet or something. And I was kind of fixed on the program. And he was talking and talking. And I sort of wanted to watch the TV program, you know. And he was talking about something. And I think he realized that the TV was winning. So at one point, he stuck his whole face right in front of me. And he went, and you know what I said? I'll never forget that. It was so funny. It was so him. And then there was another...
How did he treat the new people?
Well, he never coddled to them. But he always treated them very respectfully, and then he gave them a lot of space, especially if they were in his house. He would offer them some coffee and some, if there were any cookies or anything there.
Yeah.
And then he, because I remember when I was there, I got a chance to like sort of snuggle into his living room, because there was a lot to look at in the living room. There were all those books and pictures and knickknacks and tchotchkes all over the place. And so then he would kind of keep busy. And I think that was his way of letting someone, maybe he just knew that addicts didn't like to be smothered or something. I don't know. But he kind of let people warm up to the place first. And then if they wanted to be of service, I think he found out what their niche was. And he just had a way of making them feel a part of, you know. He never tolerated, one time I said a bad off-color joke. Oh, and he got on me so bad.
Yeah, he would let you know when he was upset.
Yeah, yeah. He did not, he was very direct.
Yeah.
Very direct when he didn't like something. And then he got on with it.
Yeah.
He would leave it alone after that.
Move on. Yeah.
And so you knew, he had a good way of letting you know what his boundaries were.
Yeah.
And I had a good respect for him about that. And he didn't have time for gossip and idle chatter. I don't remember him. I remember one time when we were on that office on Vineland Avenue for a while.
Right.
I remember one time he was on his legs, you know, doing the UPS orders. And somebody came in, you know, one more time to just really not do any work, just give advice.
Uh-huh.
You know, those people that come in and just take up about a good half hour, you know, giving their input as to how best to run the World Service Office.
Right.
But meanwhile, they wouldn't be, you know, offering to, you know, put any starter kits together or doing anything productive. So they were going on and on, and I'm sitting there at the desk, and I'm wondering, why isn't he saying anything? You know, and because he just kept busy.
Right.
You know, he kept busy tying the, or taping up these packages. And he would just keep going, to them, right? And I'm going, what does he mean? That's clearly not what he thinks. Why is he even agreeing with that idiot? This is what I'm thinking, right? And then I saw him, like, itching his ear. And I realized later that what he was doing was shutting his hearing aid off. He would just shut it off because he had to get this work done, is what his thinking was. So he didn't want to be rude and kick these people out of the office. So he'd let them go on and on. Yeah. And hold on a second. Turn off my cell phone.
By the way, it seems like if you leave here in about 12 minutes, you'll catch a plane.
Yeah, we got to wrap this up.
Right.
But it's really been so cool being here with you, Chuck, because I know that, you know, I think about some of the assignments that he put you and I on, especially when it came to some of the conference early, you know, those, like, I think it was 80, 81, those years, like the world directories. And I remember sometimes, I do remember one time saying, how are we going to get this out? We've got to get it out. And we'll get it out. Because I was always working on the principle of expediency.
Yeah.
Like, because I felt like sometimes the fellowship was like this big wolf on the door.
Yeah.
You know, like, come on, we want our stuff. You know, and I really was working on the, you know, like I felt like, you know, we got to please them, you know. But Jimmy never worked on that principle of expediency. He always wanted what went out of the office to be
right,
look right, and be a product of what Narcotics Anonymous represented. In other words, no mistakes if possible. And it was what it was. And so I remember we were bargaining one year, one year I said, Jimmy said something. I said, okay, I'll make you a deal. I'll type that if you get this world directory out or something. I don't know what it was. But, so I just remember a very fond times. You had a really good relationship with him, though. You were very patient with him, and he, and I know that he really loved you very much.
Oh,
and
I loved him.
Yeah.
I know you loved him, too.
Yeah. I haven't found a house like that.
Yeah.
You know, to go to and just feel, you know. But I'm glad and very grateful that I got to spend a little time with him, and, you know, and
house is still there. And
it is. It's like an auto recycling place.
Different look to it, but it's still there.
Yeah, the structure is there.
Very cool stuff. Yeah.
Well, is there anything in closing that you want to say?
We'll always be grateful for Jimmy and all that he did, and for being, I feel real fortunate and grateful that he was a part of my life. And I again, like I said the other day, he would get real angry when you talked about gratitude unless you were doing something. So I feel like, yeah, I got to continue on.
And do you think his vision came about?
Oh, I think it is.
Yeah,
I think it's going to be, he said his idea was one day we're going to eat up AA. it's becoming a lot bigger. How about you?
I'm very grateful too, and I'm very proud to be a member of AA, and I'll always treasure the time that, you know, I treasure the time that I got to spend with him, and you know, and for having this fellowship. I mean, for, you know, I'm forever grateful that he paved the way and put in so much of his life for people like you and me, and he certainly gave new meaning to the word usefulness and purpose, and I still look at his writings and some of the things that he wrote, and I find so much meaning and inspiration in them today, you know, as I continue to grow. So anyway, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you very much for doing all this stuff.
Can I ask you a bonus question? Maybe it'll turn out that you already covered this stuff when I was out of the room, but it seems to me that Jimmy must have faced peculiar problems that Mother Teresa didn't face, for instance, because Jimmy's work was primarily with a bunch of drug addicts involved with the California penal system, which is a bear all by itself. See what I mean?
I think what you're saying is that he faced problems that most people don't face. Yeah, I think that's true. You know, and I think it takes a very special person to be able to do what he did. You know, to be able to get along with
mm-hmm.
you know, somebody just got out of prison, he knew exactly how to talk to them. You know, if they're just coming into fellowship, he knew exactly how to talk to them.
And even the officials, the police departments,
exactly.
And the judges, they had a tremendous amount of respect because he knew how to approach people. He had a spiritual sense of who he was, and he loved himself. He was a spiritual man, and he knew how to communicate with people in a good way.
Yeah, I think why he was so good is his heart was into Narcotics Anonymous, of carrying the message. So that when you get into that mode, that takes all the fear and all the ego and all that stuff out of it. And I think that's why he was so great.
Well, he was carrying the message.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for keeping this alive.
Thank you.